It's the film with three brains. 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 It's the film with three brains.
Oh my god, you guys are freaks.
Welcome to the film with three brains. I'm Cohen in Maplewood, New Jersey.
This is Sean in Chicago.
And Sam in San Francisco.
The movie we are discussing today is a it's not a classic. I don't even know. I guess it's a cult movie.
Don't build up the audience.
It's a real wild card.
Yeah. I don't know if it even lives up to that. But it's called Sleepaway Camp. It is a slasher film, much in the mold of Friday the 13th, Halloween. Came out in 1983. You can probably argue it's a knockoff of those. And it is notable to us in that we all saw it together when we were 12. At Sam's birthday party, right? Your birthday party. Yep. at your house. We watched a couple of movies. I don't remember what else. Somehow all I remember was Sleepaway Camp. Because I will say this for it, it is memorable.
Oh yeah. Memorable.
Has anybody seen it since then? In between viewings?
I must have, because it was pretty fresh in my brain when I watched it again a couple nights ago. Like, nothing was surprising about it. It's like, oh, I remember this. Oh, yeah, I remember that. So that's too long to go and still remember it that well. I must have seen it at least once or twice in the interim. What about you guys?
No, I hadn't. No. But I think that the deaths are not, I shouldn't say all of them, but some of the deaths are particularly memorable just because you don't see them in any, person killed with beehive, like that just doesn't show up anywhere else.
Murder by beehive, other than Wicker Man with Nicolas Cage. Although he survived that, he just later they got him. But yeah, so let's rewind slightly. Brief synopsis for our viewers who have never seen it and maybe never will. But Sleepaway Camp is about obviously it's a camp, a sleepaway camp where people start getting murdered. It's a kind of a whodunit type deal. Wow, I really just described it in like six words, huh?
Well, it's kind of like I was trying to think of a way to describe it and be like, oh, a guy named Mel runs a camp for teenagers who are about to be slaughtered.
It really is. It is a true knockoff of Friday the 13th in every way. I mean, not in every way, but obviously, I mean, it's a camp and kids get killed. So maybe you should do a spoiler. I mean, I feel like we're going to have to talk about the end. So let's just, spoiler
kind of thing? The end is what makes this movie special, because there's no other horror movie that throws you for a loop like that. And it's not no horror movie needs to throw you for a loop like that. But that's what made it memorable.
I was thinking about this today. I was thinking, is that a twist ending exactly? Is that really I don't know. I mean, it is, of course it is, but it's not like a complete reversal. It's not, I don't know.
You can kind of see it coming. I mean, it's not, the whodunit part is not all that, difficult to figure out.
Yeah.
There's like two possibilities.
Right.
True.
Right. Maybe it's the girl who's being bullied. Yeah.
Or maybe her cousin.
Right. Or the quote unquote boyfriend. All right. So that's the rough synopsis. Before we get into it too much, I'd just like to point out that one, the director, whose name was Robert Hiltzik, never did anything of note. The cast is pretty forgettable. The only thing about it is that there's the kid who plays her ever so brief boyfriend, is an actor named Christopher Colay. I always say Colette, but it's Colay. And he's been in a few things. In the 80s, he was the lead in a movie called First Born with Terry Garr and Peter Weller, which I always liked, about an abusive stepfather and the young son has to like stand up to him. It's a drama. It's pretty good, actually. And then he played the sort of Matthew Broderick type character, from War Games, in a movie called The Manhattan Project, about a kid. If you guys have seen it, if you remember, it's about a kid who builds basically a nuclear bomb from books he read in the library, just to see if he can do it. And that one was actually pretty good, too. And then he never did much of anything else except for Prayer for the Roller Boys with Corey Haim. But otherwise, everyone else in it is, you know, didn't do much, if anything at all.
Well, I mean, so the Mel, the Stogie smoking.
Well, that guy, right.
Oh, guy. Him.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's, I guess.
He's in a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
But he did, Mel died before this movie was released by a couple months.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Ben, the guy, one of the guys in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, why does his voice sound familiar? And I looked him up and he's Robert Earl Jones. He is James Earl Jones' father.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Hmm. It's great.
And he's so, done stuff as well.
Sleepaway Camp was a star-studded film. In 1983. All A-list, all the way. The girl who's the lead, her name's Felisa Rowe. Felisa? I don't know.
It's like Felisa with an F?
Yeah, Felisa Rose. She didn't do much of anything either until the second, third, fourth Sleepaway Camp movie. They made sequels, Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3, starring Bruce Springsteen's younger sister, Pamela Springsteen, playing that role.
Oh.
Anyway, I'm going to give a much more detailed synopsis just for our listeners, because we're talking about this movie. They don't know what the hell we're talking about because no one's seen it but us. So Sleepaway Camp, it opens in a weird boating scene where a father and his two kids, a girl and a boy, are in a boat and they capsize and another boat hits them. There's a girl on that other boat that hits them who screams a lot. Oh my God, we hit them. It's a terrible performance. We find out that the father and one of the kids got killed and the other kid goes to live with her aunt, who's a total raving lunatic. Really weird.
We don't really know that right then, right? We don't know who's dead and who's,
torn up. All we know is she speaks
the guy's
about,
dead.
She speaks about Angela, her niece Angela, and how her and her son are, Ricky, are going to camp. That's all we know.
Okay.
That's all she says. And
we know,
right.
Somebody died. And
right. Well, we know, right. Sorry. We know that the father died and that one of the kids died. That's all we know.
Gotcha.
And so she sends him off to camp. This girl, Angela, her niece is bullied pretty relentlessly, pretty early on. Ricky tries to sort of look out for her, but you know, he's just one kid. And people who are mean to her start turning up dead in pretty gruesome ways. She does befriend one of the boys who becomes her sort of boyfriend. He quote unquote cheats on her when he kisses another girl who's one of the bullies. And, he does not end up living through the movie. Anyway,
so I think talking about this movie, we might as well go full spoilers.
Because, yeah.
Yeah. All the way.
Cause otherwise it's not worth talking about.
You're right. So we should just, when you guys want to finish it out,
go for it. Sean.
Well, I mean, let's start. We should really talk about the murders themselves. Cause I looked, one of the links on the Wikipedia is like Den of Geeks or something. And the director talks about how he made the movie with kind of the beginning and the end in mind. And then he just filled it in.
Yeah.
And that was at the camp that he used to go to, that camp.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Part of the reason they used that. But for the most part, I think it's really, yeah, it's the interesting deaths and how silly and, you know, bizarre and everything else, and weird acting and weird everything in between. But really it's about what, I don't know if it's memorable because of when we were kids, but though, yeah, the bees and that, you mentioned, something in the hoo-ha.
Right.
Like curling iron.
In the vagina.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess that was, yeah. I mean, mixed with smothering, pillow smothering.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Smother the pillow.
The obligatory arching death, the arrow in the throat.
Right. Right. And actually the very first person is the creeper, the cook.
Yeah.
At the camp, who's a total creeper and basically implies he's going to rape her. And then he gets boiling water poured over. And I would just like to point out that is that stock pot, that can't be real, right? That had to have been built for this movie.
I was thinking that too. I'm like, I don't think I've seen some big ones. I don't think
it was like
ever
4 feet
that.
Tall. Yeah. He literally had a ladder that he climbed up on so he could stir it. It was like the beginning of Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he's having breakfast and like everything's gigantic. His fork and his knife are huge. And then there's this giant stock pot. But he might have lived. We don't really know.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But he definitely had it coming because, yeah, I think he was caught in the middle of sexually assaulting her. He was undoing his pants to this, you know, preteen girl.
Right.
For right off the bat, it's like right. One of the first things that happens. And I think he's the first victim.
I think the thing that always struck me is kind of funny about this movie in that regard is that in sort of the reverse of most movies, it starts at sort of the worst affront to the victim character who turns out to be the killer. It starts right. with the worst and it gets slowly more and more kind of petty. So when it all culminates, you're like, all right, so she cut off this kid's head because he kissed another girl at camp. You know, first guy tries
well
to
what about
her.
The little kids in the sleeping bags, they got their heads chopped off just because they teased her.
I didn't realize, I know. Yeah, no, because right. they threw sand at her when
right
she
they threw sand she, at her
yeah she, they threw sand at her
yeah so it's like almost which rape then bullying. You know, being really mean, you know, cruel, and then being a little less cruel, but still dicks. And then like a boy is like, oh, I just kissed this other girl. Oh, no, sorry. So yeah, instead of sort of escalating and escalating and escalating, it was actually sort of the reverse. Her reactions were getting more and more crazy.
And did Mel even have any reason to get killed? I mean, he was, or did he just came
well,
across
he,
her?
He kicked the hell out of her cousin, Ricky.
Yeah.
Who was always
oh,
nice to
oh yes oh definitely.
Because he thought Ricky definitely. Was the killer.
Yeah, that was brutal.
So he like beat him within an inch of his life,
like a deranged orangutan.
Yeah.
Like a deranged orangutan. I just he was flailing with his he's like ah, I just I'm gonna you know
yeah his lower jaw's all
and he was paying back a death of a counselor who
oh right
what she was what 18 May. Maybe
yeah
yes
and they had some
him
yeah they had some weird
disgusting
date.
Way
yeah and they were supposed to meet up and then
that was the most disturbing part of the movie.
Yeah, well
there's lots of disturbing parts.
There's a lot of disturbing stuff. Some is intentional, some is not. But yeah, I mean like you said early on, this movie is most memorable for its ending, which at the time when we were kids scared the bejesus out of me. Like that stuck with me for a long time. I really found it unsettling. And watching it again, it mm-hmm. still kind of made my skin crawl.
It still is freaky. Her face.
Well, face the look the on her face is so perfect. Like that's the best acting in this entire movie. Like that, like that face. And I just started dying laughing. And when I saw it this time, because it was comical, but at the same time perfect. I was like, oh my gosh, that's like. You can't ask for better.
Yeah.
For so better. Let's reveal it to our listeners. Spoiler alert, we're going to tell you how this ends. So
give them the whole scene, like the whole setup.
Angela kills all these counselors or all these campers and counselors and all these people who have, you know, wronged her in some way, including her would-be boyfriend. They find her sitting on the beach naked with his head in her lap.
Stroking his hair.
And she stands up and I can't remember, is she holding his head?
She drops it to the side.
Yeah. And she has a knife in her hand and she's standing there completely naked and she's growling like a fucking dog or, you know, something feral. Oh, weird.
Exactly.
Dog on cue.
Well done.
And her mouth is frozen wide open with her eyes bugged out. She's looking to the side and her tongue's out just a tiny bit. Sort of like the people who got killed in The Ring. Have you ever seen The Ring? Where their faces are frozen in like horror and terror and unnaturally sort of wide way. That's the way her face looks, and she's breathing and kind of snarling, and she looks completely feral, and she's naked, and then the full frontal nudity, you see she has testicles and a big old penis. So Angela is not a girl, she's the boy. The girl got killed by the boat, and the psychotic aunt already had a little boy, her son Ricky, so she raised this boy, her nephew, as a girl. So at the time, it was very unsettling. Oh my God, it's a boy! Oh my God!
We gotta mention Dan Davis's reaction.
What was it? I don't remember.
Is anyone else? Dan. Yeah, Dan was like, "It's a she's a he's a. That was pretty much it. He just was like, couldn't finish the sentence. It was perfect. It was like somebody wrote it in the script.
Yeah,
and it was much better than the actor who says, "What, he's a she or something?"
Yeah, something like that. I don't remember exactly.
Meanwhile, there's a head on the ground. She's got the hatchet, mm-hmm. and all. I mean, he says very calmly, "He's a she." Like he doesn't like run away or right. scream or react to this. He just says, "Oh."
And as part of the reveal, I think it's, I can't remember the exact timing. I think it's at the end. They do a flashback to the dead father when he was alive, laying in bed with another man,
mm-hmm.
you know, and playing like grab ass or some weird little, you know, they're like giggling and shit, you know, and the kids like see it.
Mm-hmm.
So as a 12-year-old, you know, or however old we are, we don't, you know, none of that made a whole lot of sense. Only that it was like, oh, clearly this child was traumatized by a variety of things that made her a killer. But really, I mean, if you really think about it and sort of put it under a microscope, the sort of, you know, the gender roles and the sort of things around this movie are just really terrible.
You know? Yeah.
Like the things they're saying are kind of awful.
Yeah.
Like this woman became little boy became, I mean, it's sort of demonizing A, homosexuals, B, transgender.
Yep. And there's no mention of gender identity. It's just sort of, I mean, I guess you could say it's the bullying part. That's
sure.
The impetus, you could,
but then they hang their hat on the,
right.
the gender twist. And yeah, while shocking at the time, and even still, you're kind of like, wow, what? It's still odd.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, so being raised as a girl when you're a boy means you're going to grow up to be a psychopath.
Yeah, pretty much.
And if your father's a homosexual, well, you're screwed then. You're totally murdering everyone at camp.
Apparently that guy was the guy on the beach in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I certainly didn't know it then, but even now. I read it and I was like, oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah.
That's those. It's two dads raising yeah. these two kids.
Right.
But then and then the flashback makes it like apparent what they're going for. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
That messed it. That really messed with everything. I don't know. And they're pointing at each other too.
I mean, that's the implication. The implication is that if a child is raised by two men,
mm-hmm.
they're psychologically scarred. It's sort of the idea because and it's just the way they handled the flashback when they showed it.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they reveal the killer and then show a flashback of her as a boy, like witnessing her father with his boyfriend. As if that is an explanation for her murderous ways, you know?
Right.
We're not just but an explanation, you know, a contributing factor, which is kind of awful.
Do you remember when they send him off to camp and she says, here, I've got your physicals, and she hands him over?
Yeah.
So that wouldn't do at all in their crazy bad acting way or whatever it was.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I guess it wasn't that terrible because she is really crazy, but it's very strange, the whole thing. But
yeah.
I guess is that supposed to throw us off the scent? Oh, well, you know, a doctor has approved these two people. They're,
no,
well,
they're good to go. She says she did them.
Yeah.
She did the physicals.
That's our clue that something's not right.
That's a bit of a foreshadowing.
Okay. You know,
yeah. Sort of.
It's a complex movie, Sean. You got to watch at least 3 or 4 times.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to study this for a while.
I know. I honestly, the whole time I was watching, I was thinking, Jesus, this is really giving The Usual Suspects a run for its money. I was like, wait. Oh, and
momentum. Like, I was like, their outfits.
They're, oh, yeah. Totally.
Tiny shorts.
It was made in 1983. We dressed like fools.
And what was the obsession with softball? They loved softball. It was they were gambling on it, and it was such a big deal. And then, oh, we're gonna play the counselors, and I got a game.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I guess.
Sure. Why not? So watching it as an adult, I still, I, I was not surprised that they ended up making sequels. You know, there are some effective things about it. There, it's better than your average Friday the 13th knockoff, I would say. I don't know. Would you guys agree?
Yeah, I think it's the only movie I can think of where the very final shot, it's like the conclusion. There's no denouement. There's just boom, last shot. It changes color.
Yeah.
You know, cue music, cue credits immediately.
Like, yeah.
Really fast. So I mean, I give it credit for that.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other.
It's movies. An effective and efficient ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes the movie unforgettable. Everything else you can forget, but that you won't forget.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, you know, watching this movie, that when you actually watch a lot of the people die, that it's like if someone was trying to kill you, you'd fight back. But if you watch a lot of these deaths, they're like frozen. Like the guy who gets the water on him is just hanging on to the counter or the shelving, saying, "Don't do that! Don't do that!" Like, you just walk yourself backwards. Like the woman in the shower, the girl in the shower, she just stands there leaning against the shower, as the knife is going in and then down, and it creates like a 1 foot long cut in her back. She never runs away, you know, pushes herself forward or anything. It's like everybody's just frozen. The kid with the beehive, like you can go underneath the door, the stall.
Like, I know, it's just lean into it, it'd probably pop open. They're so weird,
right? You know,
so it's, or it's like throw the beehive back out the window,
right? So, like sometimes I'll be brushing my teeth and I'll fake that the electric toothbrush is like either electrocuting or strangling me, and I think I put up a bigger fight than a lot of people in this movie because I'm writhing on the floor with foamy toothpaste coming out my mouth. So that's something I was like, well, they could remake this movie and just make all the, you know, make the deaths, you know, make the people actually act and that. But the way people die is kind of fun, and that's part of why you watch these movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So the sleepover that we actually see is the one in the woods with the, you know, the guy that draws the straw. He has to go with the kids, the younger kids, I guess.
Yeah.
And that shot of their torn up sleeping bags, it's pretty vague. It's kind of dark.
Yeah, it is. It is. You're right. It's really strange.
You're like, oh, okay. So they, I guess, you know, this, I see some feathers. They must have down sleeping bags or something, but I don't know. And also that happens, kind of in between a couple other murders. So
yeah,
as a killer, she has to really move fast.
Yeah.
Busy night. Yeah.
Yeah. Busy night. Yeah. She picks up the pace toward the end.
Yeah, that's true. And there's no, yeah, I mean,
I mean, we can nitpick a ton of stuff, but that was the only thing that was like, well, wait a minute, could there be a second killer? I mean, it's supposed to be one killer.
Right.
Where is her cousin at that point, at the end, I guess?
Well,
he was getting beat up.
Right.
Almost killed him.
And does he just lay on the ground?
Yeah, so he's just like writhing in pain.
Okay. So he's out of the picture. And then the boyfriend, Paul or whatever, he's hanging out on the beach, whistling and just waiting for his his makeout session. Gets more than he bargained for.
And then he gets his goddamn head cut off.
And then we should probably talk about that. What's her name that he kisses, and that's the transgression.
Like, oh, yeah. Well, I can't remember her name. Was it Judy or something?
Judy.
The other camper who's super mean to Angela.
Yeah. She's involved in almost everything. She's involved in messing with him for some reason. She dated Ricky, I guess, before any of this happens, because he comes back in the camp.
Right. Last year at the camp, yeah. I guess they were a couple.
Which is kind of odd. So she's toying with
a very memorable death, though. I mean, curling iron in the
chest. So
it's not the usual way to die.
So they made a couple of sequels, and I don't know if you guys remember the sequel, Sleepaway Camp 2. I forgot what the subtitle was. Something goofy. But do you remember the movie poster, or like the VHS cover at the video store was a picture of an adult Angela with a backpack, and in the backpack is Freddy Krueger's glove and Jason's hockey mask.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Which, yeah, yeah. Which even as a kid kind of struck me as, I didn't know the word at the time, but sort of hubris, you know?
Yeah.
Like to just automatically assume you're in that same camp as those two movies, two of the most well-known sort of 80s slasher movies, you know? Unhappy Campers. That was the subtitle of the sequel.
Oh, okay. Was it saying that she's on par with them, or she leaves them in the dust?
Yeah. Well, it was, what was the tagline? There was a goofy tagline like,
Unhappy Campers.
No, well, that was the title, but, man, I can't remember what it was and I can't find it now.
I will say that in Sleepaway Camp 2, two of the people who are in there dress up as Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees to try to scare her, and she ends up killing them. So that's how the mask and the glove get.
So the tagline is on that poster is when you go camping, just take the essentials. So she's
all right, that makes sense. Sort of.
I actually don't think I've ever seen 2, 3, or 4, which is surprising because I mean I've seen Roadhouse 2 for Christ's sake.
Like, well,
I'm a glutton for terrible sequels. I cannot help myself.
Sam, did you see the sequel?
You don't even need it to be a sequel. You'll see a terrible movie. Period.
Well, of course.
But no. The kicker is that he knows it's going to be terrible going in because it's a sequel. Right. He goes anyway.
I would just like to point out that do you remember the movie House? Maybe we should talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
There are 4 of those, and I own them all on Blu-ray. There's a box set, and I have it.
One of Roger, two boxes sold.
Say your prayers.
Say your prayers, Roger. That's right. God. With William Catt.
I wonder if that movie is still any good.
It is.
Yeah.
I watched it about 4 months ago.
Are you serious?
100% serious. You don't get a Blu-ray box set of House and now at least watch the first one immediately.
I guess that's true.
I didn't get it that long ago, so I watched.
All right, so I have a tiny bit of info here.
All right.
I was looking up about this movie and I came across Esquire magazine did a 50 best horror films from the 1980s list. I'm like, okay, I'm going to scroll through this and see if this movie even makes it onto this list. Because, you know, frankly, this is not that great of a movie. So I'm going through and I'm starting up at number 50. And at like number 48, April Fool's Day. And I was like, oh, I really like that movie. I thought it'd be higher than this. So then I see things. I'm going through American Werewolf in London, The Gate. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to get to good stuff like Pet Sematary and Fright Night and Child's Play. And I'm up like at like 25, and I'm like, oh, this movie's clearly not on this list. I keep scrolling.
Oh boy.
It's number 17, Sleepaway Camp. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And so, the obvious winners are things like The Shining, and they had aliens in there as a horror movie, so that was in there. But they have that right behind The Evil Dead.
Yeah.
They have it a couple behind Poltergeist and Gremlins. So whoever did this list really, really liked this movie. But in their review, their thing, you know, the thing that they say is the superbly shocking finale.
Yeah.
Which is the decade's biggest and best horror blindside. That's their exact words. And it's true. So for this one person making this list, it had the same effect on him or her as it did us.
Yeah.
You know, that memorable moment, you know. And there's other movies on here that are above it that I'm like, I don't remember, or I don't know if I've seen, or maybe not seen. Like one of them's Near Dark, which I can't remember if I saw it or not. And I'm like, how could I forget that if I did see it? You know, it has Bill Paxton in it. Number 17 out of 50, that's pretty good.
That is pretty good. Especially, I just looked up the list real quick. And like, I don't know. I'm looking at the ones that are below it. You know, higher numbered stuff. It's all stuff I've seen, but Friday the 13th, number 22. Hellraiser, no, Hellraiser, which scared the bejesus out of me when I was a kid, 23.
Creepshow, The Hitcher, they're all in there.
The Hitcher
memorable good. 80s movies. You know,
Changeling. Jeez.
Yeah, I saw a list of the 50 greatest twist endings, you know, with the Sixth Sense and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
So I get, yeah, like you were saying, it's pretty much all about the ending.
Yeah, it is. I mean, on the surface, it's an extraordinarily effective ending. It's just when you sort of sit down and think about it, you start to unravel it and think,
I thought it was.
Don't think about it too much.
Yeah, just be a kid when you
accept it. Accept it at face value and be unnerved by it, because the way it's handled is very unnerving. It looks like, oh my god. Ugh.
So it's one of those movies where it's good to be a kid, but really you shouldn't be. You shouldn't watch this if you're a kid. If you're a young kid,
probably not. Like, why did we? How did we get our hands on it?
My parents rented it. You know, my parents. I'm looking through this list. My parents let me watch Poltergeist when I was like 9 years old.
Oh yeah.
And they used to laugh. My mom used to laugh at that sort of thing. Like, oh, the chicken's crawling across the counter, you know? So yeah. And I think having a sister who was, you know, 4 years older, who also, you know, rented all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And that's how I was able to see A Nightmare on Elm Street for the first time, you know, is whenever that came out. We were pretty young, at the video store with my sister again, also who's 4 years older. And my parents being like, well, that's okay. And my sister's like, yeah, it's fine. It's just kind of funny. It's not really that scary. Meanwhile, I watch it. I don't sleep again for 3 years or something. Terrified out of my mind, because all I have dreams about, I have nightmares about Freddy friggin' Krueger. Thank you.
So this movie, despite our not glowing reviews, did actually really well. Yeah. You know how much money they made this movie for?
Oh, I would guess like $200,000-$300,000 or something like that.
They made it for $350,000.
Yeah.
The box office take $11 million.
Yeah, I was gonna say probably like $10 million. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
I mean, that's a pretty big return on your investment. No, yeah. I mean, they don't make sequels to movies that didn't make money, especially in the '80s.
Yeah. He talks about making the movie. He was in grad school or something, and he's a lawyer now. He still is. I think he kind of convinced he wasn't going to graduate or something, and they kind of got people to get on his side and say, hey, he's making a feature film here. How can you deny him his diploma and you know, for film school or something? He also said he didn't like some of the other horror movies, and he must have been referring to Friday the 13th, something like that, where they use older actors, and he used actual kids.
Right, right. Yeah, which, that's true.
You know,
I mean, that's a valid point. Where, I mean, if you watch Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis is like freaking 30. She's supposed to be in high school. I mean, I don't know if she's that old, but she looks old.
Yeah. You know?
Definitely. Yeah, that's true. The Sleepaway Camp kids were all kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they had work rules, and they had tutors and stuff for school. And he said he was pretty proud of, that it starts with the changing leaves and showing the camp closed in the after, like, you know, the end, the beginning is the end, or the aftermath, I guess. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? They show turning leaves, and it's obviously fall.
Yeah.
And then they go back and okay, everything's green again. But that was actually because they finished in October shooting. And if you know, I guess I didn't notice it myself, but you can see some of the leaves changing as you is in some of the scenes like that. But he was proud that they were got one day behind from the boating, the beginning scene. And after that, they were only one day behind the entire shooting schedule. So he seemed pretty pleased with the entire thing. I mean, even though he never did anything but that return to Sleepaway Camp.
Right. Yeah. Was that the fourth one or whatever?
Yeah.
I don't know. Look, if I was a young struggling filmmaker and I managed to get this production off the ground and get it made, I'd be proud of it. Why not? yeah. It is effective, you know, and for all its goofiness and strange shit, strange decisions made it. I mean, that just the ending alone, you know, like you came up with something and it worked.
Yeah.
You know, most horror movies don't have a very effective ending for the most part. They just, you know,
right.
I mean, the whole thing, Friday 13th ending was pretty good when you find out it's his mom. You know, that's pretty effective.
You just ruined it for me.
Sorry. But then it's, you know, horror movies tend to rely on like a button at the end. You know, Friday 13th, oh, he's still in the lake? You know, where she like, yeah. She's in the boat and then he comes up and he's all deformed and takes her down and she wakes up in the hospital. Or Nightmare on Elm Street where, you know, the mom's standing in the stoop and then the hand like reaches through the door window and pulls her through and you're like, oh, okay. You know.
Yeah. Why is that like called a button? I'm not just, let me ask a dumb question here.
Button's just like, you know, it's like the topper on the thing. It's
okay.
In a commercial, it's the thing they show as a quick little joke after like the client, the company's logo. And they put a little button on the end.
Okay.
Something funny usually. But yeah.
It's a staple of horror now that there is something at the end.
Yeah.
They have to, because if it makes money, they're going to make a sequel and they have to leave that at that opening, you know.
But isn't it partly because the dread doesn't go away when you're done watching it?
Oh yeah, that way you'll lose sleep for 3 years thinking about
Freddy Krueger,
because it can pull you right through the door. And that pulling through the only scene is so ridiculous.
Oh yeah, like clearly it's a friggin' rag doll.
Yes.
It's like a hard cut and then it's like, what? Just pulled like a Raggedy Andy, you know, through the window.
Yeah. Almost as good as the stunt double in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. You remember the woman who gets in a fight and it turns and the stunt double is actually a guy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think of Spaceballs for that.
Yeah.
You captured the stunt doubles.
That's right. But yeah, when it comes to like truly effective endings to horror movies, you know, this one's always stuck with me. The Japanese version of The Ring was another one that really I saw the Japanese version before the American version, and the Japanese version the ending's a bit more effective. If I don't know if you guys remember how it ends, but it's totally unnerving in every way. That one stuck with me for a while too.
I should check that out. I'm only seeing the American version.
The ending's the same. It's just, it's handled slightly differently.
Is the tape itself this similar?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause the tape itself is pretty freaky. Just that those cuts and those images.
In the Japanese version at the end, when she comes out of the TV, mm-hmm. the apartment's much smaller. It's not like a big loft apartment. It's a tiny apartment. It's weirdly dark. There's no video jittery, you know, weird Avid farts in it at all, you know, the way she pixelates in the American version, none of that. It's played very straight. She comes out of the TV in a small apartment. He's got nowhere to go and she kills him. It's gross. You're like,
I saw the original version of The Grudge.
Yeah.
That was pretty freaky.
Yeah. I saw that too.
Yeah.
So there's no real segue here, but I was thinking about these 80s movies. And I was thinking that in the last few years, I'd say that horror movies have had a renaissance.
Sure.
I can't really think of anything between like 1990 and 2010 that really sticks with me. I mean, The Ring is maybe the only one that is a horror movie that I'd be like, okay, what other horror movies would I pick from that time period?
I think in that time period.
You know, we were young, so these things were memorable.
I think in that time period, American horror films are very fixated on remaking Japanese horror films. Mm. You know, so you had movies like The Ring, The Grudge. There were a few others, The Signal or whatever the hell. There was a bunch of stuff. And it was sort of the doldrums of American horror. It wasn't good. You know, The Ring was pretty good. And then after that, it just got diluted. There wasn't a whole lot going on. I don't know. I'm hard pressed to think of memorable horror movies.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably list 30 memorable 80s horror movies and a bunch from the last couple of years that were actually good. I mean, even nominated for Academy Awards, but that gap in between,
yeah,
I don't think I could name 20. I mean, I could name like Scream, you know, in this.
Right. Well, that's another thing. So there was the whole J-horror thing, and then there was Scream, which was all, and after that, there was all the knockoffs. I Know What You Did Last Summer, Teaching Mrs. Tingle, all this garbage, because the self-referential deconstruction thing was so successful with Scream, everyone started doing it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I mean, that's the way American films, you know, Hollywood is, I guess. It's something successful, and then there's a series of knockoffs, and then, you know, and then there's something else that's successful in a series of knockoffs. I mean, Jesus Christ, how many knockoffs of Pulp Fiction came out in the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, in the early 2000s. Jeez. Yeah. My God.
Ugh, you know, 2 days in a valley.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Things to do in Denver when you're dead. I mean, it's a long list.
Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah.
Match.
That one's not so bad.
We didn't say they're all bad.
Well,
but horror is definitely cyclical, of course. And then, I mean, there was definitely a renaissance, you know, with movies like The Conjuring, Sinister, and
The Craft, right? Was that
The Craft, dude?
I don't know.
No,
I haven't seen The Craft.
It was like the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about like late 90s or like 2000s, you know. And of course, I mean, what the hell? I was gonna say The Blair Witch Project, obviously.
There's one
ushered in a huge movement in the found footage, you know, quote unquote reality type thing. That came out in 1999. And then, so the early 2000s were just completely saturated with that sort of dreck, you know, and most of it was terrible. And it went on for far too long. You know, Blair Witch Project I thought it was fantastic. I loved it. But Paranormal Activity was a pretty good, you know, knockoff. And then, but everything else, there was so much of it. Yeah, even now, there's still. They're still doing it. They're still doing found footage horror movies now, even now.
Right.
20 years later.
The budget's so low. I mean, how can you resist?
Yeah. You know, and every once in a while, something decent comes out, you know, that you're like, oh, okay, maybe it's not a completely used up conceit. But I mean, really, that's what it was. The 2000s were just completely dominated by the found footage horror movie. It's like, Jesus, enough. You know, the thing that sort of broke that spell was what I was saying before, is things like The Conjuring, I think, you know. Jason Blum, who has Blumhouse, basically has produced every major horror film in the last like 10, 15 years. It's crazy. Anyway, we're talking about Sleepaway Camp.
Repeat it. Yeah.
You know what it's known as in England?
What?
Nightmare Vacation.
Nightmare Vacation?
That's what it says on Wikipedia.
Huh.
Which is silly, because I guess that's the American. They're trying to give it an American name, because they would call it Holiday, not Vacation. But.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why they would call it that at all, but
yeah, I don't know. It makes it sound like a crossover with the Vacation franchise with Chevy Chase.
I'd see that. I'd watch that.
Yeah, why not? I don't know. There's a few of those. Well, there's spinoffs too, but
I mean, Audrey's nearly dead in every movie anyway. So
Nightmare Vacation. I don't know if Camp and Vacation is the same thing. I don't know.
No, it doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. I'm not sure why they released it that way.
Totally. So, are there a few quotes from this movie I had forgotten. You know, really stuck with me over the years as an adult adolescent at heart.
I know what's coming.
I think we all do.
Do you?
Go ahead, say it.
Go ahead. Yep. Give it to us.
Yeah, when they ask the one guy who was sort of a bully. But they said, hey, are you coming to the whatever? He goes, yeah.
Go to that softball game.
Yeah. Oh, you're coming to the game. Yeah, but first I got to take a wicked dump. And I actually forgotten that's where that phrase comes from in my personal lexicon. And I'm not afraid to admit I've said it. Oh, I don't know.
A few thousand times.
A few thousand times since 1983. But as soon as he said it, I was like, oh my God, that's right.
I don't know if we ever started saying this, but I like when they're in the they're playing the softball game, giving each other crap about the dozens of dollars they're gonna win, and I think he says, eat shit and die, Ricky, and he goes, eat shit and live, Bill. I like that one. Eat, I don't know. Live. Yeah, like yeah. That's somehow worse. Ooh, he one upped you there.
Yeah, that's way worse.
And then the expletive tirade he goes on in the somewhere. Well, they're throwing the water balloons from the roof.
Yeah,
and he just goes off.
There was a pretty decent line from one of the bitchy female campers about Angelos. She said she's flat as a board.
Yeah, it's a carpenter's dream.
Right, a carpenter's dream, flat as a board, in need of a nail. Was that or need something like
screw.
That? Need of a screw, not a nail. A screw. Need a screw.
That is a good one. And too bad we live in the wrong time period and the wrong age that we'll never be able to say that to anybody.
Right. It'll just live in our memories. That's all. I think I'd use the eat shit and live, but I mean only if someone told me to eat shit and die.
Right.
Which could happen. Definitely.
Maybe.
Happen.
A little tired.
I have to admit, I've said it on the road a few times to people.
Really? What do you mean two people? Like two
well,
them?
They can't hear
like,
me. No, yeah, I'm just
you're
in the
car driving yes. And someone cuts you off. You're like, eat shit and die, fucker.
Yep.
Oh, hey, I have one last little after the factoid for Sleepaway Camp. The film editor, Sharon Ross,
yeah,
later did the film editing for Ernest Goes to Jail and Ernest Saves Christmas.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Two movies I would have never remembered existed had I not looked at this.
Yeah. The Ernest movies. That is crazy that they made a bunch of those.
Promise me we won't be reviewing those.
Well, you know what, though? No, we can't.
I'll swear to promise. That.
No. I'm not. I'll tell you why. Because Ernest Goes to Camp has a couple of legitimate laughs. And
wow. How can I say no to that?
And I would like to say that there is a long history of American filmmakers trying to somehow capitalize on the success of commercial campaigns in the movie world. And it never works. 99.99999% of the time. And somehow, by basic metrics that Hollywood would use, which is basically money, the Ernest movies were a success. Jesus.
So
do you guys remember what they were commercials for?
Oh, I have no idea.
I can kind of see them in my head. I definitely.
Hey, Vern. It's Ernest.
Yeah. Hey, Vern. Ernest. Shoot.
Fast food? I don't know.
It's a Red Roof Inns? No, it's not it. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Oh, they're going to tell me. Because I can see him. I can see him talking stuff. But
it was like a. What was it? It was
all right. Somebody look that up and I'll talk about the next movie. How about that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we are going to have a palate cleanser of sorts, or I just. Maybe, you know, as different a movie as I can think of. It's going to be from 1992. We've already talked about this a little bit. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Nice.
All right.
That is definitely a personal favorite.
Yeah. You know, dialogue heavy, serious shit going on.
Very famous Alec Baldwin speech.
Very few beheadings.
Very little in the way of violent murder. And no fighting.
No fighting.
No punches thrown.
Yeah, right. This could be. Is this our first one with no violence at all? I'm not sure. I think there is a little bit of violence in there.
There's verbal
on screen violence. Or off screen. Yeah, there's definitely some shit going on. But all right, who was in charge of looking up Ernest? Because that's gonna bug me.
I'm looking at. Ernest was in various television ad campaigns, including national products he promoted were for Coca-Cola, Chex, and Taco John's.
I think it's the Coke commercials that I was thinking of.
Oh, is it New Coke? That'd be cool.
I don't know
That'd
about that.
No, that was He Who Shall Not Be Named, who is in prison now.
There are 9 Ernest movies. Oh my God. 4 of them direct to video.
Only 4?
Yes.
Wow.
but your point is well taken. Awesome. There, so not any other movie franchise has really come from a total ad campaign kind of.
Not really. I'm trying to think of some. There must be some, but I don't really remember. I mean, Jim Varney, I think, may have been. No. Oh, right. No. The character was created by an ad agency.
Yeah. Okay.
And right, I think the first was for Coke, and it was very successful. And Avern. Yeah, Avern's Ernest and Vern was off camera, never seen. But I mean, I can't think of anything else. I mean, I know the stupid Geico caveman. They made a television series on that was yanked after like two episodes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, but, I know what you're talking about.
But yeah, in terms of movies, I don't know.
Well, if we do Ernest Goes to Camp, we will certainly beat that one to death.
Oh, man. All right. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Glengarry Glen Ross. That's a good one.
See you guys next time.
Well, hold on. I would just like to point out that perhaps, I don't know, maybe I really feel strongly that this was probably our best review.
Oh, yeah. You know, how could I forget that? Second thought.
I mean, this was riveting.
Yes.
For everyone.
Unparalleled.
Involved. Yes. I don't know how we're going to top it. We're going to try next time.
Welcome, listeners.
When we discuss Glengarry Glen Ross.
That's right.
We'll see you then.
Adios.
Thanks for listening.